Welcome to the KSTE Farm Hour. Here's KSTE's Farmer Fred, Fred Hoffman.
There's some good news this week for California's farmers. More medium grain rice from the Sacramento Valley is headed to China. And the federal government has okayed more funding to fight that 20-pound rodent that's a threat to Delta area farmland, the nutria. The weather is going to get considerably colder in the days ahead. How cold? Well, will it get cold enough to damage young walnut trees and orchards? We don't know that, but we do know a farm advisor who has precautions that walnut growers should now be considering. Also, we delve into the frontiers of agricultural science, the use of biologics on California farmland. That includes cutting-edge products such as biostimulants for the soil and plant growth regulators for bigger crops. We have all that, crop reports, the extended weather, and more on this week's KSTE Farm Hour. Let's get started. There's more California rice headed to China. The Ag Alert newspaper reports California-grown rice unloaded at a Chinese port last week completed the first shipment of U.S.-grown rice to China. The USA Rice Federation says the premium medium grain rice from California will be sold by a Chinese retail chain known as Sungiven. Chinese importers visited California and two other rice-growing states last year as part of a long-standing effort to open the market to U.S. rice.
The Department of Labor this week announced a change in how farm labor rate increases are determined. Allison Crittenden, American Farm Bureau Federation Congressional Relations Director, says the final rule no longer uses USDA's Farm Labor Survey for workers who fall under core farm occupations.
So we're no longer using the survey-based wage methodology that have all those drastic swings from year to year of a 23% increase in 1 year or a 10% increase in a different region. Instead, we're moving to a two-year freeze and then using the employment cost index, which isn't as volatile, to dictate the increases starting in 2023.
Crittenden says farmers need the predictability provided by the final rule.
That provides stability and some level of predictability, especially for the next 2 years, knowing that wages won't increase until 2023 for those that qualify for the core farm occupations. Predictability and stability are very needed right now during the pandemic and all of the market uncertainty that we're still facing.
Crittenden says the final rule puts in place a fair process that doesn't undermine the efforts to pay farm workers fair wages.
But it allows farmers to plan for the year ahead without having a drastic increase thrust on them at the beginning of the year. The ECI is a more stable index with increases ranging approximately 2.24% each year on average over the last decade. So it's something that allows farmers to predict and plan and figure out their labor needs while still paying a fair wage to their employees.
Michael Clements, Washington.
California's flower growers are also suffering a world of hurt. The Ag Alert newspaper reports that low-priced flowers from Central and South America have driven many California flower growers out of business, and representatives say a new decision may accelerate that trend. The U.S. Trade Representative's office says it will allow roses from Ecuador to enter the U.S. duty-free. The California Cut Flower Commission describes its members as disappointed and says imports have already pushed more than three-quarters of U.S. rose growers out of business.
USDA is wrapping up its survey work for next week's new production forecast for this season's corn, soybean, and cotton crops. Lance Honig heads the crops branch of USDA's Statistics Service. He told us,
"We've been busy reaching out to about 8,000 producers across the country, asking them to give us updates on their expectations of yield for the season."
And for many farmers, these are not expectations. They are finished or very close to finishing the harvest.
So in most cases, these producers are actually giving us yield information based on their actual harvest results.
So we have farmer surveys.
But in addition to that, we've also got our trained enumerators out in nearly 4,000 sample plots, specifically for corn, soybeans, and cotton across the major growing areas.
They're running counts and doing measurements and harvesting samples for lab analysis.
So really getting a lot of finality around these numbers.
So the USDA projections should be pretty close to what the final actual production will be. Those projections coming out Tuesday the 10th, noon Eastern Time. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Here's USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey with a look at the national weather picture for the period of November 10th through the 16th.
Warm weather will linger across the eastern one-third of the country and along the Gulf Coast, but we will see a gradual push of colder air across the western and central United States as we head toward and into mid-November. along with that transition in temperature, colder in the west, remaining warm in the east, we do expect a fairly stormy weather pattern to the end that most of the country is expecting at least near or above normal precipitation during that time. Greatest likelihood of wet conditions will occur across parts of the Midwest, also expecting some wetter conditions along the Atlantic seaboard and in the northwest. Drier than normal conditions from November 10th through the 16th should be confined to parts of the western and central Gulf Coast, as well as the High Plains region stretching from Montana and the western Dakotas southward into North Texas.
For the southern Sacramento and northern San Joaquin Valleys, the coming week looks to be very interesting as far as weather goes. Computer models disagree, but that means there's a chance of rain on Thursday and Friday. Otherwise, partly cloudy skies will prevail, and it's going to get a bit on the cold side as well, with overnight lows Monday morning dipping down into the low 30s. For the rest of the week, the lows look to be in the upper 30s to low 40s. Daytime highs will be in the low 60s.
Drought is still a problem for some parts of the country.
And we are seeing some significant topsoil moisture shortages here, even this late in the season, from the plains westward.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey points to some notable areas of dryness.
And we did see some significant improvement in a few areas, but we still see every state except Oklahoma, Arizona, and Washington across the western half of the country showing topsoil moisture at least 50% very short to short.
He says Oklahoma was able to get off the list of seriously dry states because of major improvements in its moisture ratings.
A drop from 69 to 23% very short to short on account of the significant storm system that moved through the region. But we still have some really big numbers for shortages in the west, led by Utah, 83% very short to short.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Here's this week's California Crop Report. In Tulare County, harvested fields were being disked and prepared for winter silage or other forage crops. Silage corn, mostly harvested. Alfalfa continues to be irrigated, cut, dried, and baled. Dry beans were harvested. Cotton is being harvested. Sudan grass was being cut, dried, and baled. In the Sacramento Valley, fall groundwork continues. It's winding down, though. Rice harvest is nearly complete. The wheat planting has begun. Corn and sunflower harvests are ongoing. The stone fruit harvest season is essentially complete. Some orchards were pushed out for new plantings. Pomegranate, pear, kiwi, and table grape harvests are ongoing. Navel orange maturation continues. Harvesting is beginning in some areas. The Valencia orange harvest is nearly complete. Persimmon, olive, lemon, lime, pomelo, pineapple, quince, and grapefruit harvests continue. Almond harvest was complete in many areas of the state. Walnut, pecan, and pistachio harvests are nearly complete. In Sacramento, Solano, and Yolo counties, the processing tomato harvest is complete. Fall groundwork, though, continues. Melons are being picked. Eggplant, peppers, sweet corn, and fresh tomatoes continue to mature and are being harvested. Fall vegetables were picked for farmers' markets. Pumpkins are being harvested. Garlic is getting planted. Irrigated pasture is reported to be in good condition. Foothill rangeland and non-irrigated pasture was in poor condition. Sheep are grazing on retired cropland as well as harvested grain field. Cattle were moved down from higher elevation ranges in preparation for winter. Cattle supplemental feeding is ongoing. Bees continue to be moved into California for overwintering. Orange County's wind-driven Silverado fire, which began back on October 26th in the hills northeast of Irvine, left agricultural damage in its wake. And local farmers say it points out the need for vegetation management, especially grazing, according to area ranchers. This is Orange County Farmer and County Farm Bureau President Mark Lopez.
Mark Lopez here, Orange County Farm Bureau, down here in Orange County, Irvine, California. Silverado fire, as we're speaking, you can see one of our barns burned down. We've got avocados in the back. We've got strawberries, trying to get our strawberries in the ground. Just hoping we can do some collaboration. These fuel loads that we can't bring in some animals to do it, be labor, it would be labor intensive. I don't know much to say about it, but we've got burned avocados. Got my barn is down. We've got pieces of tractors burned. see what we can do.
The California Farm Bureau reports that total statewide losses and damages for ranchers remains unknown as recovery and assessments continue in burned out areas. But initial estimates are starting to emerge in areas where the fires are contained, such as up here in Northern California. The SCU Lightning Complex fire, which burned 396,000 acres of primarily rangeland in Alameda, Santa Clara, San Joaquin, Merced, Contra Costa, and Stanislaus counties, reached an estimated $68 million. That according to an initial conservative estimate by the University of California. A summer of smoke and ash in many parts of California has raised questions about the safety of produce that's growing on farms as well as in backyard gardens, as well as eggs laid by chickens who peck around in ash-laden areas, and remediation needed to safely and effectively grow food in the future. Researchers at UC Davis say that the chemicals found in the smoke don't just stay in the air, they can deposit onto plants and into the soil and water. The researchers collected over 200 samples of homegrown collard greens, lettuce, kale, and chard that were exposed to wildfire smoke and ash in the North Bay as well as in Sonoma County. Fortunately, no samples had detectable levels of lead, arsenic, mercury, or chromium, and that's a huge sigh of relief. And the question has been raised, in a fire area, are backyard chicken eggs safe to eat? Might there be contaminants in the eggs laid by backyard poultry that live and feed in areas exposed to wildfire, ash, and smoke? Scientists know that from previous research that chickens exposed to lead in their environment can produce eggs with high lead content, and that heavy metal content of ash from urban fires is higher than that from rural wildfires. Thus, urban wildfires could pose a risk for the production of eggs and poultry that contain heavy metals. As a result, UC researchers put out a call for eggs from backyard poultry growers. They received samples from 344 premises in fire-affected and non-fire-affected areas of California. Surprisingly, egg samples that contained the higher lead levels came from parts of the state that were not directly impacted by ash and smoke, which raises the question, so is it safe to eat eggs from backyard poultry? The researchers can't give a definitive answer to that question, but they do suggest that you assess your risk and reduce the risk of contamination. Practices that reduce the risk include keeping chickens off the ground, using a chicken feeder that prevents spillage onto the ground, and making calcium readily available, for example, in the form of oyster shells, because calcium can prevent the absorption of lead. Make sure that chickens are provided uncontaminated water is also an important part of risk reduction. And finally, are soils safe for growing food after a fire? Fire's effects on soil is another consideration in burned areas. Fires heat topsoil layers. They reduce the amount of living microorganisms at the site of the burn, and they also affect organic matter and nutrients. Plus, ash deposits over time can make soils more alkaline. The good news is, with proper land care and management, soils can be remediated over time. Some ways to improve safety when gardening or farming in fire-affected areas include keeping the soil covered with wood chips or other landscape mulch to reduce airborne soil dust. Use drip irrigation to prevent upsplash onto the underside of growing vegetables. Promote good drainage, especially at the bottom of slopes, to prevent the concentration of contaminants. Still, lab tests are often needed to determine the soil's post-fire characteristics. Researchers recommend concerned landowners to test their soil.
Response to the second round of USDA's coronavirus food assistance program has been strong.
As of October 22nd, we've approved over 443,000 applications, and we've approved for payment a little over $7.6 billion for the CFAP 2 program in payments.
That was Farm Service Agency Administrator Richard Fordyce.
CFAP 1 and CFAP 2 are two unique programs. In some cases, CFAP 2 is similar to CFAP 1, but in others, it's a little different.
Therefore, ag producers who received funds under CFAP 1 will have to submit another application for CFAP 2.
There's a number of resources that folks can utilize at the farmers.gov/CFAP website. There's FAQs there. There's also an application, you know, that producers may want to look at to kind of familiarize themselves with the application and maybe what information is needed.
He says the program is aimed at helping ag producers mitigate losses,
either in price losses due to the coronavirus pandemic, or or disruptions in supply chain, deliveries, those kind of things, marketing disruptions.
There are three categories for CFAP 2 payments.
One is a sales commodities category, and that's where we're going to take a look at those producers that are in that sales commodities, which would include specialty crops. Tobacco actually is in CFAP 2, aquaculture, and other kind of sales-based commodities. We're going to look at their 2019 sales.
The second category is price trigger commodities.
Those would be, you know, more of our major row crops, livestock, and dairy. And so, you know, we'll need to know some production numbers.
The third category is flat rate row crops.
And these would be crops that either don't have a significant acreage across the country, or maybe either didn't meet a 5% price decline, or we didn't have sufficient data to determine if it met a 5% price decline.
Meanwhile, USDA has expanded the list of commodities eligible for payments under CFAP 2.
So, you know, I would use those resources that we mentioned on the website, farmers.gov/CFAP. There will be a listing of eligible commodities, but there is a significant increase in what those are compared to CFAP 1.
Again, he says the deadline to apply is December 11th.
In a lot of parts of the country, harvest is kind of wrapping up. So hopefully, you know, our producers across the country are, you know, have maybe a little bit more time. They're able to get into the office or contact the office so that they can file an application for CFAP 2.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
There's more money to eradicate nutrias in California. Nutria is that 20-pound swamp rodent that is a threat to farmlands, especially in the Delta area. The president recently signed into law a bill to reauthorize the Nutria Eradication and Control Act of 2003. The bill will provide federal assistance for states dealing with nutria issues. California is among the states that will receive federal support under the bill. It was due to legislation authored by California Representative Josh Harder, who introduced the bill back in June of 2019. Federal funding for addressing the nutria problem has been established at up to $12 million per year under that bill. Don't forget, the KSTE Farm Hour is available on your schedule. You can listen to it live, of course, at 6:50 on the AM dial here in Northern California, or stream it live via the iHeartRadio app. And, of course, the KSTE Farm Hour is available as a podcast. Download it from your favorite third-party podcast aggregator, and that includes the iHeartRadio app, Apple Music, and Google Play. The Ag Alert newspaper reports that walnut farmers say they're confronting two problems this harvest season: low prices for walnuts and thieves who trespass into orchards to steal the nuts. A number of counties have enacted ordinances to slow thefts by people who may then sell nuts on roadsides, but farmers report ongoing problems. Because of low prices, farmers say they need to sell as many nuts as they can to recoup their costs, and they don't want to lose more of their harvest to thieves. Fully dormant walnut trees are a relative frost-tolerant crop. Fully dormant mature trees can tolerate temperatures to the low 20s or even below. For walnut trees to fully acclimate and withstand severe freeze events, the first few frost events in autumn should have lows near 32 or just below. However, if the first one or two freeze events have lows down to 28 degrees, damage will likely ensue. We saw this back in 2010. It was a Thanksgiving hard freeze. That was a big surprise for that month of November in 2010. That was the first not only freeze of the season, but it was a hard freeze. There was a lot of damage. And of course, the big one, winter of 1990, Christmas week, when temperatures plunged down into the teens in many areas of the Sacramento Valley. We're talking with Luke Milliron. He's the Orchard Systems Advisor for the Cooperative Extension for Butte, Tehama, and Glenn Counties. And Luke, how can growers reduce damage of walnut trees this time of year?
Well, there's a couple things that growers can do, Fred, to reduce that potential damage. Certainly, the concern is heightened for those younger trees. So making sure that you took the proper steps in August and September to slow things down by wrapping up the fertilization program in August, and, you know, making sure that you were able to form a terminal bud and get things kind of ready for the dormant season here. The concern now is really thinking about what we can do to prepare the orchard floor for a potential freeze event. So this is often a good time to put out an irrigation if there's anything in the forecast, and ideally 3 to 5 days before a predicted hard freeze, you would irrigate and make sure that there's some moisture there in that top foot that can really act to reduce the damage.
One thing that isn't in the forecast, however, is rain, and we could use the rain. How important is an irrigated soil to the health of the tree if it's been dry like it has been? Because I've heard that there are benefits to withholding irrigation in mid-September.
Sure. So withholding irrigation, particularly on those younger trees, beginning in mid-September until that terminal vegetative bud has formed on the trunk, is important to make sure that things slow down and stop growing, but you can resume irrigation, particularly because conditions have been so dry. We have this north wind blowing, you know, we have really low relative humidities, and a lot of folks just finished harvest, so they've had to be withholding irrigation because of that. So conditions can certainly dry out. They're still leaves on the trees, and so they can continue to lose water. And so from both a frost perspective as well as just a tree health perspective, it's a good time to irrigate.
So periodic irrigation during November and December, if there is no rain, should be part of one's arsenal.
We typically think that the rainfall season really gets started in earnest in November, and hopefully that will be the case. But if it doesn't, I don't think that there's any real damage to irrigating during that time if there's no rainfall. I did my graduate work at UC Davis looking at the water status of dormant trees during the drought, and we found that almond trees in the San Joaquin Valley, at least the ones that we looked at, where there had been very little rainfall, actually weren't expressing much water stress at all during that dormant period, even going into bloom. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't make any sense to irrigate. You might want to irrigate from a frost perspective, and you might want to irrigate because you want to just keep a relatively full profile as you're headed into bloom.
So irrigation would not necessarily push out new growth.
That's correct. That's correct, particularly if things have already formed that terminal bud, then, you know, you can resume irrigation, and that's going to prevent premature defoliation. It shouldn't push out any new growth, and it will moisten the soil, which can really help in these severe frost events. So when temperatures hit 28 or below before you've had a couple of these freeze events just down to 32 or just below that help the trees acclimate. If all of a sudden we get, you know, several hours below, you know, at or below 28 degrees, you know, having some soil moisture can really help because of increased heat storage of that surface soil during the day as it receives radiation during the day. It can store up more heat if it's not totally dried out.
And it would be very important, I would think, that moisture be in the top foot of the soil or so.
Absolutely.
Before we go any further, let's talk a little bit about the terms we're using. But if you're watching the weather forecast, you may hear that a frost is predicted, a freeze, or a hard freeze. Are there technical definitions to those terms?
Well, in this context, we always think about freezes in horticulture very specific to what crop we're talking about and what time of year. But in this context, we're really considering a freeze event to be, you know, 32 degrees or below, but those can be positive this time of year because they can help the trees acclimate as we head into winter. Whereas 28 degrees or below is, in this conversation, what we're considering a hard freeze.
And I imagine a hard freeze would have to be of a certain duration, a few hours or more?
That's often the case, yes.
Now, I understand that the final step in managing frost in walnuts is painting the trunks. And why is that, and how does that work?
There used to be a lot more painting of the trunks that was advised by UC Cooperative Extension folks. And we got into some trouble back in 2014 and 2015 with some of the really bizarre winter temperatures we had. And with those temperature swings, we actually had some problems with the carbohydrates and their storage in the trunks that had been painted versus not painted. So we saw a lot of painted trunks. It was like, you know, in extension, we're always telling farmers, you know, this is what the research shows. And it was the one year that everyone went out and actually did what we told them to do. And it resulted in a lot of buds not breaking where there had been paint. And so when we're talking about these hard freeze events, several hours of 28 degrees or below, and you're concerned about damage on particularly on young walnuts, you can go out and cut into the southwest facing side of the trees and see if there's been any browning, any discoloration of the cambium. And that would be the time to paint, not necessarily painting prophylactically, but painting after you see that there's some evidence of freeze damage, and particularly painting on that southwest facing trunk surface.
I would think that the solution then might be to go with a diluted formula.
Absolutely. It's often the case that when people hear paint, they just go out and they apply, you know, undiluted paint. But we always talk about paint as a 1-to-1, a 50% diluted water to white interior latex paint. And you want to get out there as soon as possible and get that done. Work by Wilbur Reel, who's an emeritus farm advisor in the Winters area. He painted some young tulare trees up to 7 feet, and he did that 8 days after a severe frosty event, one of these hard freezes that went down to 26 degrees. And the trees that he painted only had 18% damage, whereas the unpainted trees had almost half damage. 46% of those trees were damaged. And we think that that's because the painted trees had less sunburn after the freeze event.
And it should be noted, when he was doing those tests, he was painting those trees after a freeze event.
Indeed. It was in response to the freeze event and finding that there had been some damage.
And just to emphasize one point you made about the dilution rate of 1-to-1, it's water with white interior latex paint, not exterior latex paint.
That's correct. To see photos of both what the vegetative terminal bud that was discussed looks like, as well as what the discoloration of the cambium, often on that southwest side of the tree after a hard freeze, looks like, you can go to sacvalleyorchards.com.
A few management strategies for protecting your walnut trees if there's an early freeze. We've been talking with Luke Milliron. He's the Orchard Systems Advisor for Cooperative Extension for Butte, Tehama, and Glenn Counties. Luke, thanks for a few minutes of your time.
Thank you so much, Fred.
Coming up, Cooperative Extension and UCIPM are putting together a webinar series on biologics, plant growth regulators, biostimulants. Now, what does that have to do with agriculture? Let's find out. We're talking with Rachel Long, Farm Advisor for Cooperative Extension based in Woodland. And Rachel, this series begins on November 10th, and it will go through December 9th. It's a free series. It's going to be talking about plant growth regulators, biostimulants. Who on the farm should be signing up for this webinar series?
Well, this webinar series is open to everyone, but it really is focused on agriculture and field crop production, including both field crops and also vegetable crops. And it's a hands-on training that will provide a lot of information on the use of plant growth regulators and biostimulants in crop production and how well they work. So this is something that would be of interest to farmers, to pest control advisors, to anybody who's in the agricultural industry.
So let's talk a little bit first about plant growth regulators. Now, I know how they're used in the wholesale nursery industry, basically to control the height of bedding annuals. On the farm, what is the goal of using plant regulators?
So plant growth regulators have been used for a long time in agriculture, and probably one of the biggest ones is, you know, ethylene gas that's used for ripening fruit. So plant growth regulators are hormones. They actually are what regulates plant growth and development and fruit ripening. And we've used it as a tool for years for crop production and in the food industry. So the plant growth regulators that what we've been working with is looking at whether or not you can spray them onto crops like dry beans and get better plant growth through these gibberellic acids, they're called, which is a plant hormone. So get increased growth and then get more yield and like larger sized fruit or field crop, say for dry beans or the other seed crops.
And of course, as any farmer would ask, well, does it cost out? Does the math make sense for me to invest in this?
Right. That's a really good question. And we're still in the stages of actually evaluating these plant growth regulators on crop production and yields and quality of the produce of the crop produced. And so that's what this talk, one of the talks is going to focus on, is how well do these work? Are they cost effective? Do you get returns on your investment? I actually worked with these plant growth regulators about 10 years ago, and I applied them onto dry bean plants. They were lima beans, and I didn't see any impact on yield, and that was they applied them right at bloom. But timing is critical, and this last year I actually looked at the impact of spraying the plants when they're small, so at the first and second leaf stage when they're just emerging from the ground. And at that stage, these plant growth regulators really stimulate plant growth. I mean, after I sprayed these, it looked like these plants were on steroids. They were just, you know, really, really growing very fast compared to the untreated plants. And we do get a little bit of a yield increase. But there's also a cost associated with applying with these materials. And so I think we're still in the stage of evaluating the impact on yields. And so the talk that we're going to have on the impact of plant growth regulators on plants and the timing of the sprays to try to get, you know, a bigger, larger plant is going to be the focus of this upcoming talk, to see how well it actually does work.
The other topic that's part of this webinar series put on by Cooperative Extension and IPM mm-hmm. of the University of California are biostimulants.
Biostimulants are just so interesting, and we are so fortunate to have Professor Patrick Brown from UC Davis actually talk about biostimulants and their efficacy and how well they might work for promoting plant growth. So biostimulants are essentially, they're like fertilizers, and they could be like microbial populations, like a fungi and bacteria that are really needed for plant growth. You know, the microbes in the soil definitely help with taking nutrients from the soil into the plant root for better plant growth. And so these biostimulants, either added through the drip line, you know, or applied on the soil, definitely can help with plant growth, but not always. And that's something that Dr. Brown is going to touch on. So they do work when you have some sort of stress out there, like if it's if you have some sort of drought, you know, or you have a place in the soil where you have soil compaction, or it's just getting a little bit too dry in the soil, then those microbes they can help with bringing more nutrients to the plant and then you get better plant root growth, and then you get a healthier plant. But they don't always work. You know, sometimes you see no effect. And so Dr. Patrick Brown has been studying these biostimulants for many, many years. And he's going to talk about, you know, how they work, why they work, and when they work. And I think it's going to be pretty exciting program to hear his information, because he's been studying this for years.
Yeah, I would think of biostimulants as being hamburger helper for plants. You put it much more scholarly and say they are more like probiotics.
Exactly. You know, just like we take probiotics, you know, whether it's in yogurt or, you know, capsules or something that for increasing the our healthy gut system. Because there are beneficial microbes that help like us digest food. And just like we need healthy microorganisms, plants need healthy microorganisms in the soil to extract nutrients, especially like phosphorus, and that you need those fungal mycorrhizae to extract that phosphorus for plant growth. So I consider the biostimulants truly the probiotics of the ag world.
Well, it's interesting that biostimulants, as you put it, help buffer the plant when there is a stressor, but if conditions are perfect, you won't see any impact.
Right, exactly. So if the plant is really happy and it's got all the right conditions for growth, like you've got a soil that's got, you know, good organic matter, and then and it's got, you know, right amount of nutrients, right amount of water, right amount of light, that those plants are definitely going to grow strong and healthy. And regardless if you have the added biostimulants or not. But when you do have any stress, and we've had a lot of stresses lately in terms of, you know, like we've had really high temperatures this summer that definitely affected crop production. Under those conditions, boy, if you have a healthy plant with a bigger root system, that those plants are definitely gonna be much more resilient than a plant that doesn't have as big of a root system to withstand those stresses. So those biostimulants definitely are just helping to get a really good, strong plant and with good root growth. But again, you know, if conditions are perfect, then you might not see any differences with those products.
Now, for the farmer whose job it is in the farming family to fill out all the bureaucratic paperwork and take care of all the logistical hurdles of dealing with the state and the federal government, they're probably wondering at this point, well, you're talking biostimulants. Is it a fertilizer or is it a pesticide?
So it's not a pesticide. So biostimulants are, it's still in the stage of trying to define exactly what they are. So they'll, right now, they're considered like fertilizer additives, so they're not regulated by the Department of Pesticide Regulation. So plant growth regulators are considered a pesticide, and they are regulated by the Department of Pesticide Regulation. But biostimulants, we're still actually in the phase of trying to decide exactly how they are going to be regulated and probably as fertilizers. But that's going to be the focus of another talk, and biostimulants from a regulatory perspective from somebody from the fertilizer CDFA program. And because it's still, we're still, that these biostimulants are new enough in the United States. They're used extensively in Europe, and the laws and regulations are already set there. But here in the United States, it's still we're still working on developing the regulations, and that's going to be the focus of a talk by one of our speakers.
All right, well, let's wrap this up by going in detail about this webinar series. It begins on November 10th, and again, you don't have to travel anywhere. You can just sign up and go onto your computer to listen in on these talks. And I imagine people can ask questions as well.
Absolutely. So they can register at our site. Then once they're registered, then these are free. We also have continuing education units for this program. And the talks are about an hour long, and then we'll open them up for questions with the speaker afterwards. So we have a series of four talks. One is on the biostimulants on November 10th, and then we have the plant growth regulators on November 18th, the biostimulants from a regulatory perspective on December 3rd, and then IPM and biostimulants on December 9th.
And again, if you want to sign up for this, and you do have to sign up ahead of time for this, probably the easiest way to do it would be to do an internet search on the term biologics educational webinar series. UCANR, and it'll probably pop up. So again, that's Biologics Educational Webinar Series, and then use the initials UCANR, and the information on this will pop up. But I'll put a link to it, too, on FarmerFred.com. The series, again, it's free. We should point that out.
Right. There's no charge for this event. Just sign up beforehand, and then the link to the site will be sent to you so that you can log into that site.
The site itself is ucanr.edu/sites/UCExpertsTalk. ucanr.edu/sites/UCExpertsTalk. And it starts November 10th, which, by the way, is Tuesday. And then there'll be another one on November 18th and December 3rd and December 9th. Four different experts, each tackling a topic of biostimulants and plant growth regulators and the regulatory perspective, which is very important.
That I think it's going to be a really, really interesting talk because it's going to focus on just our current knowledge about these different products.
And that last talk on December 9th is something that has me kind of curious about integrating crop biologics into an integrated pest management system. I wouldn't think there would be an issue with that.
No, there's not. You know, what it really comes down to, I think, is the timing of applying these products. And, you know, timing is everything. And if you just apply them too late or not in the right way, then you won't see any efficacy on these products. So that's something that that the presenters are going to be focusing on.
And again, it's the University of California Cooperative Extension and UCIPM Biologics Educational Webinar Series. Sign up for free and learn more about the future of agriculture. Rachel Long, Cooperative Extension Farm Advisor based in Woodland. Thanks for telling us about this.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to the KSTE Farm Hour. Heard every Sunday from noon until 1 p.m. Pacific Time. And available anytime as a podcast at kste.com.